We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on WILL AM 580, Illinois Public Media. The producer of Focus is Harriet Williamson, and at the controls today we have Kyle Mabry. Today in this hour of Focus, we're talking with the authors of a new book called Glass Ceilings and 100-Hour Couples, What the Opt-Out Phenomenon Can Teach Us About Work and Family. It was published by University of Georgia Press, and it was written by our guests today, Karine Moe and Diana Shandy. A few years ago, the media reported that some professional women, just when they reached the peak of their earning capacity, were deciding to stay at home with their children. And so our guest today decided to study this phenomenon to see what it could tell us about balancing work and parenting. They bring together both an anthropological and an economic analysis. Karine Moe is F.R. Bigelow Professor of Economics at McAllister College, and Diana Shandy is an Associate Professor of Anthropology at McAllister College, and they're visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. Now, you can hear their talk on these issues today at 4 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, or you can join them at the Illini Union Bookstore between 1 and 3 in the Author's Corner, and they will be there signing books and answering questions. Now, if you would like to join our conversation on the radio with a comment or question, call in at 217-333-9455 or use our toll-free line 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Karine Moe and Diana Shandy, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And we're delighted that you're here. Now, you begin your book with a quote from the redoubtable Eleanor Roosevelt. Maybe I could get one of you to read it.
Sure. A woman, just like a man, may have a great gift for some particular thing. That does not mean that she must give up the joy of marrying and having a home and children.
Now, this was written in 1933. And you point out that 1933, like our times, was a period of economic turbulence. But since 1933, many more women have entered the paid workforce. In fact, you point out that 6 out of every 10 women are employed, and they make up nearly half of the workforce.
That's correct, yeah.
Now, the women your research centers on, married, college-educated women, were they skeptical of Eleanor's take on things, or did they think that this seemed reasonable and they could have it all?
I think one of the things that we discovered in our research is women's perspective on this issue changed over time. So I think they entered their college years with great optimism and thought they could do it all. And then they started to have children and care for their family and juggle that with their careers. And I think that's where some of the revisiting of that initial optimism happened.
So things pretty well worked out until they had children, we could say.
I think that's yeah, a fair assessment.
But as the 21st century dawned, something changed. After years of increasing participation in the paid labor force, the numbers of married, college-educated mothers of infants who were working sharply decreased. And what's even more striking, these women left lucrative, high-powered careers. And the media said, oh, they're opting out. And that media discussion caught your attention. And so tell me a little bit how you decided to focus on that and write this book.
Well, this is Karine. I'm a labor economist, and I study women and work. And I was looking at the data, and I noticed this decline. And it surprised me because although there have been, you know, some little ups and downs over the past 50 years, the trend has certainly been consistently upward. And so I was interested in this. And at the same time, the New York Times Sunday Magazine, Lisa Belkin, did an article called The Opt-Out Revolution, where she interviewed a group of, I believe they were lawyers, very highly educated women who had all chosen to leave the so-called rat race to be home with their kids. And so this sparked a discussion, I think, in the media. It was the cover of Time magazine. It was, you know, all over. And I thought this was very interesting, and I went to see my friend and coworker Diana Shandy, who's an anthropologist, and I said, you know, I think there's a book here. I think I want to write about this. But the thing is, economists are pretty good with data and don't often actually talk to people. And that's where Diana's anthropological expertise has been so critical and invaluable. So we started talking about it. Next thing we knew, we were writing a book together.
Interesting. Now, looking at this historically, you point out that after World War II, there were more educated men than educated women. Mm-hmm. So it generally happened that an executive married a secretary, a doctor married a receptionist or a nurse, and so on. But now we have many more educated women, and so it comes to pass that an executive often marries an executive, a doctor mm-hmm. often marries a doctor, and so on and so forth. And we have two very, very demanding jobs in a single household. And these dual career couples have plenty of money, but the finite resource
is time.
Is time, yeah. So how do they deal with that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this is these demographic changes that came about when we saw women going to school, since most people meet their life partner either at work or at school. Women started to marry men who looked a lot like they did, who had the same kinds of careers, same kinds of education levels. And when you look at hours of work on average in the United States over the last, I don't know, 30 years or so, they're pretty flat. We don't see a lot of movement in average weekly work hours, except for one group, and that's for the really highly educated workers. So we saw a big spike up in the number of hours required for them. So not only were they getting jobs and marrying men who had jobs, but the work demands for both members of the couple were increasing, and this put enormous pressure on them once they had children.
Now, when you think about having children, the way we view having children has changed in our society. And your book brings up the rather provocative notion that our society today views our children as pets. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's coming from a notion that people choose to have children, right? So if you choose to have children, then you must be responsible for them. Right. And so that by making that choice, you're assuming all of the expenses, the time you need to work it out. This is an individual problem. You need to come up with an individual solution. And that's a particular to the United States, I think, a very culturally particular way of seeing how one raises children.
So how do you think other societies view this?
I think children can be seen as kind of a societal good, right? So as individuals, you're raising the next generation of workers. So you're raising the next time, every time I see someone, you know, say, well, you and your children, but it's like, well, my children are going to be the ones that contribute to your Social Security. So, like, shouldn't we have a conversation about how we might make this a win-win kind of situation?
But we're not right there right now in our society at all. If you have a cat and the vet says it's going to cost thousands of dollars for surgery, then that's your problem. You've got to decide what to do about that.
Yep.
And you think, or someone thinks, this is an idea I take it you've picked up from other writers, but mm-hmm. someone thinks that we view children in that way, an individual choice, an individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that idea, the notion of calling them pets, comes from Nancy Fulbury, who's an economist at the University of Massachusetts.
So. Okay. Well, again, I want to remind people, this is guest host Carol Spindell, and you're listening to Focus, and you can join our conversation about work and family, parenting and work, with a comment or a question for our guests at 217-333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, a lot of people have in your title, the glass ceiling. We've all heard about the glass ceiling. You know, these women are going up and up in corporations or whatever in their workplace, and then they hit their heads on the glass ceiling. But you introduce the idea of the even more deadly maternal wall. What's the difference?
Well, so a glass ceiling being a form of subtle discrimination at work. And for me, my generation, I'm in my early 40s, I think I was quite frankly shocked by some of the stories that we heard from women about how they were continuing to face discrimination at work. But then this notion of maternal walls is that women also may face these subtle forms of discrimination by virtue of being mothers, or just the idea that they might have children. They can be mothers by association. One of the examples we give in the book is how a male radiologist suggested that limiting the spaces in residency programs for radiologists for women because they were unlikely to shoulder the same amount of call. And so that, of course, makes assumptions that women are going to have children and they're going to make certain decisions about shouldering call on a group basis, so motherhood by association.
So simply because they belong to this group, which has the potential to have children, a lot of expectations are being made about how they will perform in their professional life.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we also try to be clear in the book that maternal walls can happen to different kinds of people, not just mothers. So fathers can hit maternal walls as they take on increasing care responsibilities. Non-parents can hit maternal walls as they begin to have to care for elderly parents. And we think this is going to become an increasing problem as the baby boomers move into retirement and their children they're going to live longer. And I think there's going to be increased pressure on children, adult children, to care not only for their own children but for their elderly parents. So the term maternal wall, I think, can be considered quite broadly.
Okay, so we might want to think of a caregiver wall.
Yeah.
And this is the sandwich generation that you're referring to, which takes on these dual duties. And women take that on in larger proportion, do they not, than men?
That's true. Women are much more likely to be the caregivers for elderly parents, whether it's their own or the parents of their husband.
Now, the rise in female participation in the workforce is often attributed to the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s. But your book says that it's more complex than that. Could you explain that to us?
Well, we actually go back to the pre-industrial revolution and talked about how women were working. I mean, women have always worked. They just haven't necessarily always worked for pay in the marketplace, and how it wasn't until the industrial revolution that we really saw a distinct split between the public and the private spheres, where men were more likely to go out into the marketplace and earn a wage, and single women perhaps as well, and children. But married women, and in particular married mothers, were at that point more likely to be at home. One thing I thought was really interesting when we were doing the research on this was finding out that married women mothers were more likely to work while their children were small. And then when the children were old enough to go to work, then they would drop out of the workforce and the children would enter in.
How did the mothers explain that decision? These were women who were able to make a decision, who had the kind of economic security to be able to choose to do it this way?
Well, I think the jobs were not particularly good jobs that the women were doing. And I think that they often had a grandparent who was there to take care of the children, which is another change now as people live farther away from extended family. They don't have those kinds of support systems. But and then as soon as the kid, so in effect, the kids substituted for the mother's labor market work. And then after, when we had the Great Depression, many women felt that they had to go into the labor market to help support their families. And there was a great stigma attached to that, that somehow, if your husbands couldn't afford to take care of your family, then you had to work. So after the Depression, many of those women, stepped back out of the labor force. And it wasn't until World War II that we saw with the government propaganda of Rosie the Riveter, that we saw that it was seen as more patriotic. This was your duty to go and work. It was not a social stigma at all. And it was really, I think, that movement that changed the way that women thought about the positive things about working.
Now, there were also legal changes in our legal codes that enabled women to enter and prosper in the workforce, were there not?
Sure, yeah. So in the 1960s, with the civil rights legislation, and then into the 70s, there were certainly legal rules that changed so that, companies could no longer advertise for a woman for a particular job or a man for a particular job. And what we've seen over time is that overt discrimination has lessened. It still exists. It still persists, but it's not as prevalent as perhaps the more subtle forms of discrimination. that come into play where women are trying to navigate in more of a male culture.
Now, women themselves have changed, too, because women's educational levels have gone up, have they not?
Yeah, and that's part of, I think, this perfect storm of women had the access, they had the opportunity. We see this rise in women's education levels. And again, it's going back to what Karine said earlier about meeting your spouse at work. These women just were really set up to be the first generation that experienced this. So they weren't the first generation to have the educational opportunities and jobs, but then to partner up with the spouses who do. So this 100-hour couple notion, it's really this 1990s phenomenon that I think crystallized at that point in time. And of course, 100 hours is a low ball number for the actual number of hours that some of the people that we interviewed worked, where 140 hours would actually be a more accurate representation of a two lawyer or a two physician or a two fill in the blank family might be working.
Well, who are these 100-hour couples? Tell us a little more about them when you started researching.
I think they're people who followed all the cues in life to do things right. So they excelled at school, and by excelling at school, they got nice spots in good colleges, and then they got nice opportunities in graduate school. And so they were kind of people who did everything that society told them to do. And they took advantage, worked hard, and then they found themselves in this predicament of no one told me it was going to be like this. And they never presented that in a whiny sort of way, mm-hmm. but in a, this was surprising. Many of them responded that they felt blindsided by what their life was like when they reached their 30s with jobs, husband with jobs and kids.
I mean, they also are accessible all the time now, the ideal worker. There's the smartphones, there's email. The employer can reach the worker at any time, at all times. And is that part of the stress of these extended hours?
It's part of the stress. That's the whole social media technology piece. That's a bit of a mixed bag because while it means your employer can make demands on you 24/7, it also allows women to maybe go pick up the kids from school and be checking on their smartphone if anything still came into the office. They can go on business trips and Skype, back with their kids at night. So the technology piece, that's a bit of a mixed bag.
It has advantages and disadvantages. But they are expected to put in much greater time than people did in the past in these sorts of professional careers, are they not?
Yeah, I think that we do see that in the data for this particularly narrow group of people. We see a big increase in the number of hours that they're expected to work.
Now, they also have to cope with issues of travel and issues about relocation. Mm-hmm. How does that play into this equation of time, stress, parenting?
And that's huge. To be many women, that was a factor where they would drop out of their career. So everything was going along. They had things set up in, say, Washington, D.C., and then husband gets transferred to Minneapolis or L.A., and the trailing spouse, as they're often called in literature, wasn't able to start over in the same way. But it was considered the first ideal worker couldn't give up that promotion or that transfer without detriment to his career usually. And so that was a reason that women didn't start over. And they might have been pregnant at the time or, been starting a family. And so that move would shift them out of the workforce. And for people who international assignments are increasingly a part of the work world. And so legally, some people would travel with their spouse and not be able to work if they were relocated for a year or two or three to another country.
And so those women and mothers are part of this opt-out phenomenon as well, are they not? So they're being counted as women who opted out, but they were kind of forced to opt out because of family relocation in a way. They were under a certain pressure.
Actually, many of the women that we talked to took issue with that term opt-out. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a hot-button term, but that given the choice, they would have preferred to opt in or stay in. And choice, of course, is also a loaded word. How much of this is actually choice and how much of it is structured by the way our jobs are set up and our society is set up.
Well, you point out that these days the higher level of consumer spending makes it harder for a household to make ends meet on one income.
Yeah, and they it's kind of interesting. It's actually Helen Warren has I really find her work very
Elizabeth Warren.
I've got a Helen Warren I work with. Elizabeth Warren's work on bankruptcy, I think she has a really interesting thesis where if both people are fully maxed out, both working, and they're using all of their income to pay the mortgage so they can get their kids in the right school district, and anything happens to that, they're really in deep trouble because they no longer had the woman, the other person at home who could be kind of a reserve of labor for if something happened. And so it's I think some of these women where one worker is at home, they've made very strategic choices about how to live their lives and downsizing. So I think there's a lot of – one of the things we're interested in doing with the book is kind of doing some myth-busting about what these opt-out women, oh, what their lives must be like. Because often it's we chose to live in a smaller house and we don't take vacations and we – shop at Costco, and we so people orienting their lives and making sacrifices so that they could have one parent at home because they just simply felt it was not feasible to have both of them working full on in their positions.
Okay, well, we're talking with Corrine Moe and Diana Shandy about their book, 100 Hour Couples and Glass Ceilings, or the other way around, sorry, Glass Ceilings and 100 Hour Couples. And we have a caller on line one in Champaign. Hello?
Hi. I'm wondering if you're taking notice of the fact that interrupting a career, as these opt-out women may be doing, may cause them real penalties once they get back to that career. I was an academic and took time out to raise children, and quickly found that I was out of touch with the field, and of course I had not published, and so my career was to some extent damaged by that. I have two daughters, both of whom have opted not to have children, and I think one of their reasons is that they saw that they probably couldn't continue their careers. One is an attorney and the other a clinical psychologist. In the usual way, if they took time out to have children. And I wonder if you've looked at that issue.
Yeah, about a third of our book is devoted to the downsides of opting out. We tried to take a balanced view of the issue, and we don't advocate a particular point of view in the book itself, but we do take a good, hard look at the downsides of opting out. And really, if there is a strong recommendation, it's that whenever possible, women should keep their oar in the water at some mm-hmm. level. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we did discover, and for me this was one of the surprising findings of the book, is how many women felt cornered where they could not downsize, how they were put in a position of, if you're going to be an attorney, it's all or nothing. So just how difficult it was to get some kind of part-time reduced situation, even if it's only for a period of time. So they were often faced with a are you in or are you out mm-hmm. scenario.
Yeah, and even we found that even companies and universities are not immune to this, may have very progressive-looking policies on their books. But how those policies are enacted in practice can be quite different. And so it might be that there's a policy that says you can go part-time, but then if your supervisor doesn't approve, then suddenly you're not getting very interesting assignments or you're being left out of meetings. So there was this sense among many of the women we talked to who had tried to do that part-time move that they were somehow diminished in their capacity, even though they wanted to keep that professional linkage going.
Okay.
Would
you like to ask another question?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. All right. Now, it seems like one solution would be flexible arrangements, and I know that many employers offer them. But what is the reality of that? Do people take them up on these flexible arrangements?
Well, it varies, of course. And flexibility can mean lots of different things. It can mean flexible start and end times. It can mean reduced hours. It can mean telecommuting. And so much of this is specific to the type of work that you do. But what we found was that many women felt like they couldn't take advantage of that flexibility without some kind of negative repercussion. And it did vary depending on the type of career. With women in finance feeling harder, more stress in terms of taking advantage of those flexible options. Women in science, technology, and engineering also feeling that more so than perhaps others. But there seems to be a general sense that there's a big risk that you take when you move to taking advantage of even of policies that are clearly on the books.
I was really surprised, too, to read in your book that only 15% of people you qualify as leaders believe they could take a parental leave without negative repercussions for their careers.
Yeah.
That's a little shocking.
And I mean, the concept, it's called bias avoidance. And I know when I look back at my own work trajectory and I think about when I made decisions and how I made decisions, and it probably wasn't someone saying, no, you cannot do this, but somehow I was reading the waters and I had the sense that to do well in my job, I shouldn't take a certain accommodation. And we've heard that a lot as we've gone from institution to institution, that bias avoidance is a strong force out there. And then also just the way that things shift over time and the importance of a supervisor changing. So you might have a scenario that works for you, and then you get a new supervisor, and that all changes. And so just that changing, dynamic nature of the situation. It's not that you get it figured out and you're sorted. It's a very dynamic situation, as well as your needs on the home side change. So your spouses or partners, his ability to watch the kids at a certain time, that shifts. And so it's this constantly moving system in motion that becomes tough for women to manage over time.
Okay, well, before we continue our discussion, we're going to take a brief break, and then we'll be right back with our guests, Corrine Moe and Diana Shandy. This is Carol Spindell, and you're listening to Focus.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Welcome back to Focus. This is Carol Spindell, and today we're talking with Diana Shandy and Corrine Moe, the authors of Glass Ceilings and 100-Hour Couples. And it's a book that looks at how some women, having reached the peak of their careers, decide to opt out and stay at home with their children because they simply cannot juggle all these balls. And let's go back to talking. We're talking a little bit about the idea of bias avoidance. People might have some options like flexible work arrangements or part-time work, but they feel they have to turn those down in order to be successful in their careers.
Yeah, and I think it happens even on a more of a daily basis than turning down, figuring out, well, I'm not going to take advantage of this particular policy or that policy. But many women talked about bias avoidance in their everyday life, like, well, I would never say that I'm going to pick up my kids or take them to the doctor. Instead, I would say I have an appointment. And how, managing that they always felt like they needed to maintain an image that family would have absolutely no impact on their productivity as a worker.
Now, I notice here at the university that younger men who work here at the university don't seem to feel inhibited to say that these days, that they will often say, oh, I've got to take my child to the doctor, or I've got to do this. And I have to admit, listening, I think, well, I never would have said that when I had young children at home. I would have never admitted.
We've called that the daddy card. Sometimes they play the daddy card.
And there must be an advantage to the daddy card, or they wouldn't be playing it. I mean, in our society, that must hold a certain value.
It varies from environment to environment. So when someone says, oh, can we meet at 4:30 on Friday night, I look at the list of who's being asked to go to this meeting, and I wait for somebody to play the daddy card, because then that just kind of makes it easier for me. But if that were, say, a law firm or pick another setting, not to pick on law firms, but pick another setting, and those men can be stigmatized and it can be detrimental to their career to be seen as prioritizing family over work. So I think one of the things that we're interested with this book is it's a gender issue, to be sure, and one of the questions that we're looking at is that how gender is at work in our society, but we're also looking at the culture of work and to what extent it can be flexible enough to accommodate those with caregiving responsibilities at home, sometimes children, again, sometimes an ailing spouse or parents and so on.
Do you think this is exacerbated by the economic downturn? Does the workplace or the employer now hold stronger cards as people are maybe more fearful about speaking up or asking for better conditions, maybe fearful about losing a job?
We haven't looked at that as specifically in our research. I think we're picking up some anecdotal things where people are biding their time and doing what they need to do to hold on to their job during a difficult time. But I think one of the things that we were concerned about is that maybe we're talking about something that was very topical and timely, but maybe wouldn't be enduring. And one of the things I think we're increasingly convinced of is the issues that we raise in this book are going to be with us for a long time. So even if they go latent or submerged for a while, I think these are issues that we, until we come up with ways to address this basic issue of how you have a home and raise your children and are a good worker, I think they're going to be issues that are around for a long time to come.
Now, you describe couples who planned when they were young and they talked about starting a family, starting a life together. They plan to run their household on an equal basis and both have challenging careers. But somehow, when they have children, it's the mother who cuts back on her hours and the father doesn't. Can you explain that?
I mean, clearly there are societal forces at play and in terms of expectations for gender roles. And we do see an increase in the number of dads who are cutting back on their work and taking time off and even opting out. But the numbers are so small. So they've grown at these really rapid rates, you know, doubling every 5 years. But still, it's, I'd say, 97 out of every 100 times when one worker in a couple decides they're going to leave the workforce completely, it's the woman who does it, not the man. There was one woman we interviewed in particular who I thought was interesting, and she talked about how they went through this significant calculus of how, you know, what happens if I cut back and you move forward, what happens if you cut back and I move forward, and they decided that even if he cut back and she moved forward, she would still be getting expectations, you know, the pediatrician would call her or the school would call her, that it would be harder for her to really step aside than it would be for him. And so on that basis, they decided for her to cut back and him to push forward in his career.
So she would still have two balls in the air. But this way, she has one ball and he has one ball, and they can both kind of divide up the work.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Did you look at all, or are you considering looking at all in the future at same-sex couples and how this plays out, who are parenting?
We did include same-sex couples in our—we did a survey of about 1,000 women, and same-sex couples were included in that because the marriage and the benefits piece, that varies so much from state to state, that becomes difficult to look at when you're trying to identify trends. So same-sex couples are included in our study. But one of the things we were interested in doing was trying to look at, if given the option to opt out, how does this play out? And because that just that muddies the issue a bit. So same-sex couples are included, but we don't... that's not dominant in how we write up our research.
Now, I understand from your book that if we just looked at this economically, if we look at women, these women in particular, who have spent years and years in training for the positions they hold, they suddenly have reached their capacity in the labor force, in their professions. As you said, they've done everything right. And if they opt out, as our caller said, they are going to pay a short-term economic cost, but what about the long-term economic cost? Is this a good decision strategically, long-term? Yeah.
The long-term economic costs are huge. They're huge because for every year that you're out of the workforce, you take a significant penalty in your wage. And the data shows that it's very rare that women actually ever make that up. And so when you think about retirement, contributions to retirement funds, contributions to lifetime earnings, oftentimes women either are unwilling or unable to return to the fields that they left, and they often will go to lower paying fields, lower paying jobs. The financial penalties are enormous. We talked to a lot of couples who felt like childcare was a really big obstacle for them. And one of the obstacles was financial. And so there were women we talked to who said, well, you know, I'm working now. I have one child in childcare. But when, you know, we have a second child, we're not going to be able to afford on my salary to have two children in childcare. And one of the problems, I think, with that way of thinking is that it doesn't allow you to take a long-term look at that cost. So while you may not necessarily feel like you're covering the childcare now, over the next 30 years of your work life, you would more than cover it. But I think it's very hard to think that way when you're faced with your budget and, you know, paying those bills on a weekly basis, to think long-term like that.
Yeah, it is hard to think long-term, although these same couples might think very differently, for example, about investing in a house or the number of years a car is going to keep going and how much it's going to cost them to use it and so on and so forth. They might think in other ways. But parenting, of course, is not simply an economic activity. There's so much more involved.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's something that it was really helpful to have an economist and an anthropologist to collaborate on this project, because we asked different questions. And so that importance of, even though I earn more money than my husband, I want to parent my child, you know, these kinds of things came through. And when women, they could have been at the top of their game as a broker or an attorney or whatever. And some women got to a point in their careers after years and years of working these incredible hours, and they just decided that that's not what they want to do with the rest of their lives. And it doesn't mean that they want to, you know, sit on the couch and eat bonbons, which I think is, you know, a problematic myth that's out there. But they often wanted to say, okay, I've put in my time doing that, and now I want to be a school social worker. And I just think that's really interesting, this concept of an encore career, which is, you know, how it's termed in the literature, where you go out, you do your thing, you make your money, you put in your hours, and then you want to somehow create good in the world. And we heard that again and again, just the shift in careers. And I think that's also a different dimension of how work is viewed, where it's not that you get a job and you stay on that ladder and you're only on one ladder for the rest of your life, but people get on different ladders and they move laterally and not just always up, up, up.
And these women, it sounds like, are not seeing their decision to opt out as a failure, but more as a chance to kind of reorient their lives and do something, become someone that they really want to do, really want to become a little bit of a different professional person.
They're not immune to that sense of being judged.
Uh-huh.
You know, in American society, it's cultural. What do you do? That's where we start most conversations. And they had all kinds of ways of answering that question that focused on, well, I used to be an attorney, or I'm taking a hiatus from my job as an investment broker, or they didn't want to disengage from that identity that they had worked so hard to create. So there were some misgivings. So it was contested. It's complicated, I think, in terms of how they respond to the "what do you do" question. And then others were more comfortable and at peace with their decision. I think the length of time that they had stopped being a practicing attorney or whatever field, they grew more comfortable with their change in career path.
Okay, we have a caller from Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Unfortunately, I came into this thing a little bit late, and it's an excellent program. I don't know, did you discuss or underlying problem is that we don't value children in our society? You know, you're talking about child care things. Compared to places like Sweden, have you looked at those factors or not?
Yeah, it's actually last summer I was visiting a girlfriend in Sweden, and I got to live with her and her family for about a week. And the differences in just how life unfolded on a daily basis in terms of from the get-go how things were set up so that her it was her partner, not her husband, had to take time off to care for their child. If she wanted the full maternal benefit, he had to take time off from his job as well to take his paternal benefit. And just how that from the get-go, how that shifted the dynamic in the household of who was on board for how they had set this all up. And I think also just the fact that she was entitled, legally, she was entitled to work part-time and pick up her child at 3:30, 3 days a week. She didn't have to engage in bias avoidance because it was just on the books that this is what she was doing. She was taking less pay for it, and they were okay with that. But it was just the fact that she wasn't having to hide it and sneak around with her personal problem, her child. It was accepted societally. It was accepted that we will reproduce the next generation of workers, and that wasn't problematic.
And she didn't have to negotiate that herself. It had already been negotiated.
Exactly.
Also, it's a society that's more equitable in terms of wealth, too. I don't know if you've heard about those particular studies, but anyway, very good program, and I'll continue to listen.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, about income inequity? Is there a correlation there between child care or supportive families?
Well, I think that it's the way that society is set up in countries like Sweden are just so different from the way we're set up. And, the more income equality they have there, the more wealth equality that they have there, all ties in, I think, to this idea of a common purpose that is very different in American culture, where we are much more likely to think that you build your own success, you're responsible for your own children, as we said earlier, and it's just a very different way of looking or thinking about our responsibilities, I think.
Yeah, I think in those societies, raising children is seen as a family affair, a societal affair, not just a women's issue.
Mm-hmm. And I think that also ties into something that's particularly American, where you need to be seen to take care of yourself, right? So we're very autonomous. And even when we're old and ailing, we want to pay people to come in and be invisible and take care of us and not necessarily have a family member do that. So this sense that you can do it all and you don't need help, I think that's a prevailing American cultural sentiment.
However, you might be a very self-reliant American person, mother, father, but you cannot be in two places at once. You cannot be caring for a toddler and be in the workplace, unless you're maybe Harry Potter or something. Maybe he'll be able to do that, but the rest of us can't split ourselves. So there has to be childcare. This is the big dilemma. But you write about families who are on lists for 18 to 20 months to get a place in childcare.
Childcare is a real sticky wicket, I think, that it's one of the hardest things that families negotiate. And again, this depends on the region of the country, where you live, and what kind of support structures are set up. But what we found is that people were always cobbling things together, that it was very rare that somebody had a stable one go-to childcare place that they used, that they were always trying to figure out how they were going to make it work. And these
are families with substantial financial resources in many cases.
In many cases, yes.
But they still can't come up with a stable system.
Yeah.
You described one woman who had three nannies to take care of the children. She worked such long hours.
Yeah, she had the regular full-time day nanny, and then she had her weekday evening nanny, and then she had her weekend nanny. And she said it was on the hiring of the weekend nanny that she and her husband began to reflect that, they had these children for a reason, and that wasn't what they wanted for raising their children. So
now, in the book, you write about the fact that at one point Google decided to offer in-house child care. And this seems like the kind of thing that if we're going to work out the labor force child care issue, this seems like a positive step. But what happened?
It was actually in our interviews with some directors of childcare facilities who helped us problematize the issue. And people not having the choice about where to take their kids, that there are different philosophies with how children are cared for. So that was a piece of it. But I think the bigger and more problematic piece was the concern that this buys into the 24/7 worker. So when your child is sick, you no longer can call in and say, I'm staying home with my sick child, because they have a sick child room and you can grab that kid and stick him in the back of the car and show up at work anyway, when maybe what you think as a parent is that your child needs to stay in bed and needs care from a parent. And it kind of takes that away from that autonomy or that decision-making power away from the worker.
Uh-huh. So yeah. Some parents did not want to cede that decision-making power. But was there a big demand for this in-house childcare?
Yeah, well, and that was the other issue at Google, was that there was too much demand. Demand exceeded supply, my economist speak here. And so what ended up happening was people thought that this would be a perk of their job and then did not actually have access to it. And it caused lots of problems for Google. But much of the research that's been done on this shows that firms, employers who do provide on-site childcare do get better productivity out of their workers. They have lower absenteeism. They have lower turnover. It actually is a win for employers if they can figure out how to do it correctly.
So, well, I've got to ask the economist here, why doesn't the magic of the marketplace see this tremendous shortage, these two-year wait lists for childcare, and why doesn't the marketplace respond to the demand, and why isn't there more childcare?
Well, I mean, we could talk for another hour about this, but I'll try to give you a very short version, which is that oftentimes, or almost always, the most that a parent is willing to pay for childcare is capped by what the parent earns. And so when and childcare is very labor intensive, and if you want high quality childcare, it's expensive. So if you can't afford to pay more than a certain amount, then the childcare centers can't afford to pay their workers more than that. So what ends up happening is you have this sort of vicious circle where parents can only pay so much, and then that money can only hire so much, and it leads to these shortages. So it in effect, there's a market failure.
So is there a solution? I mean, is this?
Well, one solution might be further subsidization of childcare, and whether that comes from employers recognizing that this is going to be a benefit to them, they're going to make some money off of this in terms of having better, more productive workers, or from the government. It really seems to me that that's the only way we can kind of break out of this cap.
Now, you point out that during World War II, when the government needed the labor of married mothers, and this was absolutely a desperate situation to expand the workforce, they quickly provided childcare. I was surprised to read that.
Yeah. Actually, there were more children in childcare during World War II than I believe there were in the mid-70s.
Yeah. Interesting. And they must have come up with it very quickly.
I think so, yes. But, you know, in times of war and crisis, right, it's amazing what can be done.
All right. But it sounds like the women in your book feel that they're in permanent crisis.
Yes.
And that's why they opt out. Now, even looking at that from a statistical point of view, you found that there was you could even chart when the price of childcare goes up a certain amount, so many mothers are going to stop working.
Yeah.
It doesn't add up for them.
Yeah. And there has been some research that has been done on this where they have measured we call it the price elasticity of childcare. So when the price of childcare changes by X amount, how does that affect, and in particular, mothers' employment? And one of the things that I always think about is that, you know, fathers should probably be paying for half of this childcare too. But it does seem like in our discussions that it almost always came down to what the mother was earning and whether or not she earned enough to make it worthwhile.
Although if the marriage stays together and the children then reach adulthood, they will retire together. They will share the long-term benefits or costs of these choices.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Interesting. Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to bring it to an end, our conversation there, very shortly. We just have time. Is there one last point that we've missed here that you would like to make about this? Can we go on from these women to a larger message about balancing work and family? Or
well, that's one of the things, even though we started out looking at these women who leave their jobs, for us the real take-home message was how the struggles that they face and that they were so willing to talk about because they're now out of the workforce, how it sheds light on the struggles that women who continue to juggle work and home face. So for us, it was a message about women who continue to work as much as it was telling a story of this relatively small percentage who actually left their jobs.
Well, I'd like to thank our listeners who've been listening today, our callers who called in. We've been speaking with Corrine Moe and Diana Shandy. They're the author of Glass Ceilings and 100-Hour Couples, What the Opt-Out Phenomenon Can Teach Us About Work and Family. And thanks so much for being with us today on Focus.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
And on this, where they have measured kind of the, we call it the price elasticity of childcare. So when the price of childcare changes by X amount, how does that affect, and in particular, mothers' employment? And one of the things that I always think about is that, you know, fathers should probably be paying for half of this childcare too. But it does seem like in our discussions that it almost always came down to what the mother was earning and whether or not she earned enough to make it worthwhile.
Although if the marriage stays together and the children then reach adulthood, they will retire together. They will share the long-term benefits or costs of these choices.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Interesting. Okay, well, I think we're going to have to bring it to an end, our conversation there, very shortly. We just have time. Is there one last point that we've missed here that you would like to make about this? Can we go on from these women to a larger message about balancing work and family? Or
well, that's one of the things, even though we started out looking at these women who leave their jobs, for us the real take-home message was how the struggles that they face and that they were so willing to talk about because they're now out of the workforce, how it sheds light on the struggles that women who continue to juggle work and home face. So for us it was a message about women who continue to work as much as it was telling a story of this relatively small percentage who actually left their jobs.
Well, I'd like to thank our listeners who've been listening today, our callers who called in. We've been speaking with Corrine Moe and Diana Shandy. They're the author of Glass Ceilings and 100-Hour Couples, What the Opt-Out Phenomenon Can Teach Us About Work and Family. And thanks so much for being with us today on Focus.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
Great. This is Carol Spindall. You're listening to Focus, AM 580, Illinois Public Media. And I'd also like to point out that if you would like to attend their lecture today, you can hear them speak at 4 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. You can also go to the Illini Union Bookstore to the Author's Corner, and they are going to sign books and answer questions there. Is that right, from 1 to 3?
That's correct.
So they will have books there, and you could get them to sign it. And I'd like to say that our producer today was Harriet Williamson at the controls. We had Kyle Mabry. This is Carol Spindell. You've been listening to Focus on Illinois Public Media, WILL, AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, U.S. wheat prices are sharply higher today, rebounding from last week's slide, and along the way lifting corn and soybean futures as traders are eyeing a weaker dollar, which is adding some support to the market on ideas that it is technically oversold. Corn prices up as much as 1.7%, soybeans a 0.5% higher after touching a 10-week low, or rather month, excuse me, not a week, but a month low overnight. After that broad commodity sell-off last week, we're looking at some fundamental factors re-entering the marketplace, such as some ideas about tight supplies and agricultural commodities diverging from the still slumping industrial and precious metals markets today. Some of the analysts that we're looking at today saying the market just got done to the overside, to the downside, as they're talking about the commodity grains market, and for that reason, believing that the market is moving a little bit higher. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas City now, so we check on the corn here. Well, let's begin with the wheat. Kansas City, December wheat, 745 and a quarter, up 14. March, 760 and a quarter, up 14. In the May, at 766 and three quarters, it's up 12 and a half. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 651 and a quarter, up 10 and a half. March, 685.